Welcome to the Empowering Agency Workers, a podcast for all temporary workers. If you're unsure of your rights, unsure how to find work, or just plain unsure, we're here to help. It's all too easy to be exploited, so your expert host, Julia Kermode, will empower you to succeed.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of the Empowering Agency Workers podcast. Today, I'm talking to Les Berridge, who is an award-winning recruiter, and we're going to talk about how you can make sure that you stand out amongst other job applicants, and particularly when you're applying for jobs through a recruitment agency, and how can you make sure that your application is the one that gets noticed. And I think this is a massively important topic right now, because on average, there are some 200 or so applications for every job vacancy in the UK at the moment. So this is a great episode. It's full of loads of top tips and insights from a career professional. And he knows exactly what it's like from the other side of the desk. And he's had to, you know, throughout his career, have hundreds of applications and juggle them all. So really interesting insights from Les. So let's get started. Welcome, Les, to today's podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Les Berridge. And Les has worked in recruitment throughout his career. We won't add up how many years that is, Les, no. But he's recently retired in August, and he has the highest qualification in recruitment, which is the Diploma in Recruitment Practice. And Les, you were a frontline recruiter until August when you retired. And in your own words, you say that you would rather be on the pitch scoring goals than sitting in the dugout. So it's a nice football analogy there, actually. I like that. And when you were working, you were consistently one of the top performers at Gattaca, which was your last full-time role, and you produced more revenue than anyone else, and you won their award of consultant for the year. You became the first person to reach the newly created grade of principal consultant. So all of this is really impressive stuff. And actually, our listeners will perhaps not really appreciate that the whole recruitment sector is a career in itself, because a lot of people perhaps don't come across recruitment agencies until they need them. But it's a massive industry, and you've been hugely involved in REC, which is the largest trade body for recruitment firms, and you were a member of their technology executive committee, and you're currently their chair of that committee. And that's a really interesting committee, actually, because it's enabled you to directly affect government policy around security clearance, IR35, and immigration. And also, while you were on that committee, you were awarded the Eileen Simpson Award for Outstanding Contribution to Recruitment. And you're one of the first 5 honorary fellowships of the Institute for Recruitment Professionals. So all in all, I'm absolutely delighted to have you here with us today. So huge welcome. And what we want to talk about today is really at the moment, in the current situation in relation to coronavirus. We know that there are a lot of people out of work at the moment looking for jobs. And we also know that from the recruiter's perspective, they are receiving hundreds of job applications, probably even thousands for some jobs. And for almost every single kind of role that they're recruiting for. And that is a huge volume that the recruiters are dealing with. But also, in terms of the applicants, they're not always hearing back from the recruiters, because the recruiters have such a volume to deal with. And it's actually a really difficult situation. And one of the things I want to pick your brains about today, Les, if I may, is in relation to how can the applicants stand out in amongst that crowd of hundreds or even thousands of others all going for the same roles. So what kind of tips have you got from your experience as an outstanding recruiter to make people stand out from the crowd?
Okay. Well, Julia, there are lots of things that they can do. The first and most important thing I would say is to get in early. If there are 300 or 400 applicants for a role, then I know that most agents will only look through the first 50 or 60, and they'll usually find 5 or so good candidates that they need from that, so they don't need to look through the rest. it would obviously take a lot of time for them to look through all the applicants for every role. And in most cases, there are probably two or three agents looking to fill that role, working on that assignment. So there's a need for speed from their point of view. For example, the worst thing that could happen is that they submit some really good CVs and then find that the manager's filled all the interview slots.
Wow.
There are exceptions to this. So any role which is a rare or specialist skill, you're going to get either very few people apply or very few who are right. So that's okay. In the mainstream, for everybody else, where you're looking for a fairly mainstream job, what you need to do is looking on the relevant job board several times a day, right? And have your CV, six or seven times a day.
Gosh, it's incredible. Right. Okay.
If you see a role that you think is a good match, apply as quickly as you can. Most popular jobs, although the ad might be on the job board for a week or so, because they make themselves look big, if you don't apply within the first few working hours, you might as well not bother, to be honest, for popular jobs.
Wow, okay.
That's the first thing. Second thing, it is a good idea to put in a covering letter, but we're going to talk about that in more detail later on. But I'll mention it is one thing you can do. You'll also need to send the right CV and talk to the recruiter if you can. And again, we're going to cover those points later on. Now, here's the really clever bit. If you think about it, with hundreds of CVs, how you've shrunk to a handful, the mindset of the consultant is to look for a reason to exclude you. So what they end up with is what's left is the distilled very good CVs, okay? They're under time pressure.
So, sorry to interrupt, but just picking up on that. So your experience is that the recruitment consultant is looking to not select applicants because they've got to whittle down their list. So that's a really helpful point for people to bear in mind when applying,
think about it. It's the biggest filter you have to get through. You've got to get from 300 or 400 down to three or possibly five. That's a much bigger filter than when you're applying directly to a company. So you've got to think of the mindset of the consultant. They're thinking, well, that won't do, and they find a reason they hasn't got that, hasn't done that. Bang, 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 out, out, out. And what you're left with is distilled best CVs. That's the mindset. You need to change that mindset, and this is how you do it. You must be a good match for the job to start with. There's no point in doing this if you're not a good match, and you should be able to tell if it's right, you know, in your main skill set. Call the consultant who is shortlisting. You probably won't get through, but that doesn't matter. You get through, great. But if you don't get through, leave a voicemail. But don't go rabbiting on about how your experience makes you suitable, right? That's for the recruiter to decide, and your CV must tell the story on its own anyway. So what you say is, good afternoon, good morning, whatever. My name is whatever. I've applied for that role in whatever location. I just want you to know that I can do that job. I'm available immediately, and I'm happy with the rate or salary it's advertised. Guarantee you this will have an impact on the recruiter. Firstly, I'd be grateful that you haven't bored them by talking about your experience.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear that. They're not interested at this stage, okay? Right, okay. Secondly, I think you're a quality applicant because you know the ropes, you know what they need to know, you appreciate their time, and you understand all that sort of thing. In fact, you're the sort of candidate they want to put in front of their clients, okay? And then thirdly, if you are a strong match, you are saving their time ploughing through all those CVs. So you're shifting their mindset then from thinking, no good, no good, to, ooh, this person sounds interesting. And they'll probably make a beeline for your CV and look at it. And if it is a good match, they'll at least look at it for longer and harder than all the others. Okay?
Okay.
So that's a clever thing to do.
So it's kind of about drawing attention to yourself in a really simple way, actually.
Yes,
it's
very direct.
It's not about kind of a load of fluffiness around it. It's just really straightforward. Hi, I can do the job. Bang, this is who I am. And then that recruiter will then have that applicant at the back of their mind when they're sifting.
You'll pick their interest. And like I said, the mindset changes from wanting to exclude you to they'll want to include you because that sounds good.
Okay.
It works.
Clever. I like that. I almost think that's slightly manipulative, which I think is a good thing. I think we need to, at the moment, do absolutely what we can to kind of get what we need at the moment. So I really love that. And in terms of kind of the application in itself, I know it's really easy to apply for jobs on LinkedIn or whatever, and you know, it will kind of have that almost standard CV type of thing that kind of comes from LinkedIn. When I was applying for jobs years ago, when I was just starting out, I always used to tailor my CV for absolutely every single job I was applying. And I know not everyone did. And what's the kind of current view on tailoring the CVs and applications?
Okay, well, obviously the ideal scenario is that you're a perfect fit for the job. You can just send up your standard CV, and that will get you the job. But of course, in the real world, that's not how it is, because every job and every person is different. And you have to remember that. Well, first of all, the first thing I'll say is tailoring a CV is not cheating, because you can't put down every little thing you did in each job. Otherwise, your CV would be just unwieldy and long. So you have to edit the text. Some roles, you might need to insert some missing experience just to show that you have it. An example would be somebody who's like a senior progress chaser who's looking to get to a junior buying job. Mm-hmm. Well, they may well have done a bit of buying, covering from colleagues on holiday. You know, so that you need to then add that to your CV case because it's relevant to the job that you're making. They might have also helped to source and vet new suppliers, which is part of a buyer's job rather than a progress chaser's. Because when you're in a department, you get things like holidays and shorthanded time, people are sick, so you do extra things. But if you can say you've got a bit of that experience, that will make you of more interest for, say, a junior buying job.
Yeah, and I guess it's obvious, but if it's not on your CV, the recruiter is not going to have any chance of knowing. So it sounds like it is definitely worth reviewing your CV for each and every job then.
Yes, but as per the previous point, don't take too long. And in fact, what some people do is they have two or three different CVs covering different aspects of their experience. So they can respond really quickly to any role by going, I use that CV. Now, it's okay if everything is true, but what you mustn't do is change your previous job title.
Okay.
Because that makes you look dishonest, really. Mm-hmm. You have to say what the job, you can say what was within the job, and as long as that duty was there, that's fine. But that will soon be brought up by a reference check when you as well say what job title you had and your length of service. So that'd be really stupid. And not only that, in my last job, you used to keep every CV that people sent. People would apply for different jobs, and you look at their background, and they have all different job titles within each CV, and you soon spot them. So it really isn't a smart idea to do that, because you will get found out. But do change the experience bit, depending on the job.
I think that's hilarious that you have this kind of bank of CVs, and you spot them coming round again. You think, they sound familiar.
that's the one. You recognise the name. You have a look and think, hello. Last week he was a business analyst. Now he's a project manager. Funny, that. Yeah.
So how important is kind of job titles? Because I guess people have had roles where the job title's perhaps not reflective as to what they do. So I can understand that people might be tempted to change their previous job titles on occasions. I mean, do you think there's ever any tolerance for kind of embellishing the CV a little bit in that situation?
Not for changing the job title, it's actually official title with the company. But as you quite rightly say, the same job title within different organisations can do quite different jobs. But what you need to do is like detail the experience really clearly. I mean, lots of people try and make an experienced recruiter will see through it. I want to know what you did. That's more important. Yeah. But you've got to be very careful.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess you need to, if the job title of your experience doesn't quite fit the experience, you need to be really, really clear about how the experience below that perhaps inaccurate job title is relevant for the role you're applying for. Would that be right?
Yes, I mean, you could even say on the first line of prose, although I was titled a business analyst, I did in fact do quite a bit of project management. You know, that's okay to say that.
Okay. Okay, so I mean, really, it is about being honest and drawing out the relevant things in kind of the experience that the applicant has had. And in terms of, is it always just CV or is it CV and covering letter? I think some job roles specify how they want the application to come in. But if there's no specification for a covering letter, would best practice be to include a covering letter?
Yes. I would say it's more important for perm jobs. In my opinion, an interview decision for a permanent applicant is 10% the covering letter and 90% the CV.
Okay.
Because you are expressing yourself in there. So just to say what should be in if you are writing a covering letter, and if you're sending it in the post, which is rare these days, you can either pen, handwritten or typed is fine, but obviously if you're writing it, make sure it's clear. But first of all, the covering letter, the thing you need to say first of all is that you're applying for that job, quoting its title and any reference number, because it's going to an HR person. They might have 20 jobs outstanding at that company.
Yes.
They need to know that you're applying for that job.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's fair enough. But whether it's letter or email, you must check spelling and grammar. You don't really want to put people off before they even read your CV. So if your English isn't great, get a friend or family member to help you, like you probably would have done when you're putting the CV together anyway.
Yeah, one of my pet hates when I've recruited people in the past, and I've done a reasonable amount, but nowhere near the level that you've done as a recruitment professional. But one of my pet hates was always people getting my name wrong. So they might even get it correct in the address, and then they'll say, "Dear Julie," and I'm like, "Well, I'm not Julie, I'm Julia," and you try to be forgiving because people have all sorts of kind of dyslexia and related conditions, but I do find it really hard to tolerate getting my name wrong.
Well, yes, of course. And in the same way, if you write an application letter or covering letter and there's some basic grammar or spelling mistakes in there, you know, it's a fair conclusion to say you've had all the time in the world to put this together, mm-hmm. you know, and you're still making basic mistakes. What are you going to be like if I give you a job and you're under pressure to perform? You know,
yeah.
It's a reasonable conclusion to make. So there we go. So anyway,
go on. Sorry, I was just sort of a bit of butterfly brain today, I'm sorry to say, but I just sort of flitted back to the CV side of
yes.
things. Is there an advised length for the CV? Because when I finished university and I was job searching 20 years ago, I'm sure I was told 2 pages for the CV, and I think I've increased it over time. But what's the current kind of view on the length of CVs?
There is no
okay.
limit or recommended thing to CVs, because every recipient has their own concept of what they want to receive.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be very hard to think that somebody who's worked, say, as a contractor, who's 50 years old, very skilled and able, has worked at some really good companies, to try and get that down to 2 pages, either the font would have to be so small.
Yeah.
So for somebody like that, between 3 and 6 will probably be okay.
Okay.
But you're going to get the odd recipient to go, oh, if they can't get it within 4 pages, I'm not interested. Well, maybe you don't want to work for somebody who's as unreasonable as that anyway. But when
yeah.
you're starting out and you've just left university, you probably can't do much more than fill 1 page anyway, you know. So it's down to what you've got to say and what's relevant. So I would say the record length CV I ever saw was 74 pages. And I would say that was probably a bit long, yeah.
Yeah.
This person had done a PhD, and they basically included most of their PhD final year thesis in there,
wow.
which is ridiculous.
That's impossible for you to read as a recruiter for anybody.
That's ridiculous. Yeah, so I'd say between 2 and 6 pages is probably a fair guide, but let it be as long as it needs to be. And also, and this is anybody in advertising will tell you this, what draws the eye to a piece of paper and makes it easier to read is space. If you look at newspaper advertisements, if there's a lot of space around it, it draws mm-hmm. your eye to it. So if it's all crammed full of text, it's less appealing to the eye and less interesting to read, and it puts the person off. So you don't want to make it too crammed just to try and get it to 2 pages. Better make it 3 and space it out.
Yeah, sure. And does the choice of font affect things? I mean, I know I've changed my own font preferences over my years, but I have no idea if a font would affect things from a recruitment perspective.
Yes, I think it does. There are some fonts that are just easier on the eye. Mm-hmm. I tend to use Calibri, The aerials are okay. They're just nice and plain and simple, and nothing too difficult. Why make things difficult for somebody? You want to make it easier for them to pick you out, don't you? That's the point.
Yeah, so maybe not the Comic Sans and the handwriting calligraphy type of fonts. Perhaps avoid them.
No, definitely not. No. Yeah. I've got some points on covering letters. If you want me
oh, yes, please. Yeah.
Because you may feel tempted in a covering letter to explain in detail how you're perfectly suited to the position, the company. Mm-hmm. But that's making your covering letter do the job of the CV. Let your CV say that. It is fine to make one or two quick points about yourself, sort of complement the relevant parts of your CV, and maybe even amplify something that's in your CV in outline, just in case you need to. Okay. But leave it at that. And if you're making a direct application, I know I'm mostly talking about agencies, but make one point about the company, its local prominence, or the respect it has within the industry. And then you need to end on a positive note, perhaps saying that you're very interested in the position and hope for the opportunity of an interview to demonstrate your interest.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that sounds really good, actually.
Yes.
And I've always been a fan of the covering letters when I've been recruiting, because it, as you said earlier, it gives people a chance to express themselves, whereas a CV is quite constrained in its structure. And I'm always quite interested to see what points do people bring out in a covering letter, and kind of what do they think is relevant. But I have to say, I'm not a fan of a very long covering letter, because, you know, the recruitment I've done has always had lots of applicants for roles, and as I say, nowhere near the sorts of experience you've had, and I feel time pressured, and you want to get the right candidate through to the role, but also you just don't have the time to read pages and pages and pages of stuff. So covering letters are a definite plus in your view.
Definitely.
I've seen some social media discussions whereby some people feel that covering letters shouldn't be necessary, but I'm heartened to talk to such a seasoned recruiter who is a fan of the covering letter, because I most definitely am. I was going to ask, actually, but I think you've answered it, is whether it's worth trying to have a conversation with a recruiter, and you did touch on that earlier.
I've got more to say, though. Obviously, as I explained earlier, you need to try and change the recruiter's mindset to shortlisting you. But again, there's no, your CV must make it clear by itself, because it'll be passed on to a manager, probably through another pair of hands like an HR person. It must make the case independently. So please don't go on about what a great match you are and why, and this is what I did in this job. Right? Just say that you are a good match. But if you've been shortlisted, then you'll obviously have a conversation with the recruiter who will no doubt call you. And this will be to ask you about your experience, to make sure your CV is accurate, mm-hmm. a bit about the role. If they're a decent recruiter, they'll tell you who it's with, which client. I always did.
Yeah.
No point in asking too much about the role at this stage, because this is just to whether they'll put you forward or not. You've not even got as far as an interview.
Okay.
All right. So you can ask these sort of questions actually at the interview if you get one. What you can ask is, are you a sole or preferred supplier to this client? And how many CVs will you be submitting? And at least you'll know if there are three agencies and they're all sending three, then you're one of nine.
If
the agency, they're sending five CVs, they should be happy to tell you that. I always would have done. And then, final point, in all your conversations with an agency, please be polite and professional.
As you said earlier, you're looking for a reason almost to not select people, because you're dealing with such a high volume. So I think applicants need to be very aware of how they come across, and, you know, even to the point of how they might answer the phone when the recruiter rings them up. Nobody wants to talk to someone who sounds bored or unenthusiastic or kind of whatever it might be, no matter what's going on with that person. I just don't think there's any real excuse for coming across, you know, like you're not interested in the role. And one thing that recruitment uses is they often use sort of automated applicant software. I don't know if I'm using the right technical terms, so Les, you'll have to correct me, but that's my understanding, is that they use this kind of AI type of technology when going through CVs, or some recruitment does. Is there anything an applicant can do to get through that first software sifting process?
Okay, well, if the software is any good and you are a decent match for the role, then you should get through okay. There's nothing to worry about there. But just make sure you've got the right buzzwords on your CV. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if the client's recruiting for a project manager to implement a new document management system, then your CV will or should have the words project manager, project management, and document management on it somewhere. Otherwise, how could you possibly be right? So it's what an agency would do is like get the 300 down to the ones that have those words on the CV and then look at the rest, you know, in more detail, looking at all the other factors you need to look on the CV. So make sure the buzzwords are on there, but obviously only if you do have experience on. No point in making it.
Just putting in random words might get you through the software, but I think the person will then spot it, won't they?
I think so, yeah. It's pointless doing that.
Yeah. And do you think people need to take different approaches when they're looking at a temporary or contract position versus a permanent position?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. For a start, as we've already explained, contract positions are always urgent, so there's a real need for speed. Normally, a permanent process takes a bit longer and involves second interviews, things like that. Mm-hmm. And also, as a contractor, you're probably not interested in the benefits package or the promotion prospects. Of course, they're very important to a perm applicant. So for a contract person, you'll be looking far more often, pardon me, than perm job seekers. So you need to develop a process. I would say about 20 to 25% of agencies are decent, you know. That is, they care about what they do and they do it properly. But the first thing you should do before you get anywhere near the job boards is get a list, build a list of those agencies that treat you well, that get back to you, that always name the client, they always talk about or notice when you're working and notify you of relevant jobs that you could do. They don't plug you for leads and they're financially solvent, which you can easily check these days. You can also get some referrals from other contractors. So when you're looking, the first thing you do is contact all of those agencies first just to see if they've got something suitable. And if they have, that saves you looking at job boards. Because for all you know, behind an advert on a job board could be an incompetent agency. It could be a bloke working out of his bedroom, you know. Not that necessarily means they're bad, but they're probably factoring their debts. They're probably going to have a higher staff turnover. They've got poorly worded contracts. Mm-hmm. They're maybe not even on the preferred list to supply to that client. And they're trying to flag their way in through a manager, which means you won't even get an interview, you know.
Yeah.
So you're better off saying aiming for the, you know, the decent agencies. However, if you're looking for a permanent job, whether you're out of work or not, I reckon the first thing you do is aim for your ideal job. Before you even look for a job, just have a think about the job you'd ideally really like to do, you know, and then draw up a list of organisations or companies, whatever, who might have a role like that, and send over your CV with a covering note, describing what you're looking for, containing some flattery again. Every company or public body, they're understandably proud of its achievements, its products, its market standing, its reputation. So you just need to reflect this in some way with phrases like, I'm writing to you as your products are widely recognised as market leaders, or you have an excellent reputation as a local employer, and this will definitely make an impact with them. They will keep it on file, or if they've got anything relevant, they'll come back to you.
Yeah.
If that doesn't work as a perm candidate, it'll be easier for you to get through to a consultant. And this is where you need to sort of, if you can, build up a relationship with consultants. They, to perm consultants, candidates are far more important, and they'll build what's called candidate pools. So identify the most appropriate consultant with a decent agency, and they'll specialise, first of all, in perm, and secondly, either your sector or your skill set.
Yeah.
Try and make them aware of the sort of role that you're seeking, and then keep in touch just often enough. Don't overbother, not ring them every day, but just enough so when the right job does hit their desk, they'll immediately think of you and call you straight away and you won't miss out.
Yeah.
The main difference is.
I think that's helpful actually. So you kind of want to have a balance by being by making yourself kind of by reminding the recruiter of you and how you're a brilliant candidate, but you don't want to over hassle them, that sort of thing. And the other thing I like about what you just said was the power of flattery, and I'm always quite amused by that because it feels a bit cheesy when you're writing, your company is well known to me because you have fabulous products or whatever, and you sort of think, it just feels a bit cheesy. But I think from what you're saying, it really does work and does make a difference.
Yeah. Well, Disraeli said, when flattering royalty, one should lay it on with a trowel. And it's exactly the same. They are vainer than the Kardashians, honestly, about their reputation. So you really can't go too far over the top. As long as what you say has a grain of truth, you know, if they are a respected local employer or their products are market leading, but then if they weren't, why would you be applying anyway?
Yes, that's true. And whoever is receiving that, I think, will be chuffed that someone's taken notice of what it is, you know, about that company that kind of, and they probably feel a bit validated in all the hard work they do for that company. And here's an applicant that's noticed that. So that's really positive.
Well, one way you can tell from this is when companies are actually advertise vacancies directly, for the size of an advertisement, two-thirds of it is what a great company and their reputation, and only a tiny bit's about the job, which is steep because wrong people might apply if you don't say what the job is to do and what the baseline minimum requirements are. But you look through direct company ads, they're always like that.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. And I think I have to accept that I'm guilty of that when I've recruited, because you are trying to sell the company as a great place to work. So yeah, I'd never really thought about it from that perspective. So at the moment, I think a lot of people are probably in a position where almost any work will do, if you like, but there are people who are out of work and they're applying for all sorts of different job roles, and ultimately people do want those permanent roles, but do you think it's okay for them to obviously be temping in between if they can? And then, you know, what would you say to people at the moment?
Well, if I received an application from somebody who got made redundant 6 months ago and they spent the last 4 months pushing supermarket trolleys, I would think more of them, not less of them, because I think at least you're bringing in some money, trying to pay the bills, you're doing the best you can. But obviously you can't do it for too long because your experience will date and, you know, your knowledge of the... So you've got to try very hard doing all the things I said, looking several times a day. But yes, of course, you must keep working. Work is more than a source of income, as we all know. Yes. It's many other things. It's pride, it's self-respect, it's a new set of friends. And if you're not in work, it's harder and harder to get back into a working motif.
I know you've recently kind of retired from the profession, but in your experience of your clients just before you finished in August, what are they more inclined to be recruiting for contract roles at the moment rather than permanent roles? Because that's certainly the sense that I'm picking up.
Well, very few people were recruiting for either, but there were some industries and some sectors, which of course are, you know, the essential ones, things like utilities, for example, you know. We still need water and gas in our homes, don't we? And they all had, I was an IT contract recruiter, that's what I personally did, and they all had projects running which they needed to be done, which were quite urgent. So it was depending on the sector, really, as to how much they're recruiting. And I would say of those who are recruiting, they were at that time more inclined to use contractors than perm because of longer term. There's not just the COVID-19, obviously there's Brexit as well, which is a longer term question mark. And that's bad in their thinking of it.
Yeah, Brexit is a subject I haven't really got to grips with yet in the podcast, but I have no doubt that we're going to have to face that, whatever that might look like. And of course, so in this kind of uncertainty of COVID and Brexit, then certainly if I was an employer, I'd be more inclined to bring people on a temporary or contract basis to get through that uncertainty, because you don't know what, you know, I don't think anyone knows what the world will look like in even just 6 months' time, do we?
No, not at all.
I know a lot of people are applying for a lot of different roles and they don't always hear back from recruitment agencies or from clients when they're applying directly. Should people be kind of drawing any conclusions from the fact that they don't necessarily hear anything?
Well, I don't think there's any excuse for a recruiter not to send what we call a VMR, very much regret, okay, for every applicant for every job. In my last job, we actually had automated software which sent you a nice note saying that unfortunately other candidates were a closer match and you haven't been shortlisted, but we'll put you on a database or we'll let you know about any other opportunities. And before we had that software, I actually had an automated signature.
Okay, yeah.
Click the signature and send it so that everybody did hear back. I felt very strongly it was important that if somebody's gone to trouble of applying, then they should at least hear back. Of course, every week on the bright side, I would get quite a few emails back from candidates saying, I never hear back from anybody. Thank you at least for getting back to me and letting me know and being very grateful. And I would remember these candidates because I thought, they understand, that's very polite. If there's a similar job for them, I'll try and remember them for that job.
Okay. On the downside,
I would, of course, get one or two applicants with a high sense of entitlement who are replying fairly vitriolically, how on earth did you not shortlist? I can't understand why you haven't shortlisted me. I'm a good match for this job. How dare you?
So, again, it's about standing out from the crowd. So just picking up on what you said, those applicants that said, oh, thank you very much for letting me know, then that they kind of go to the top of your list for next time. Whereas those candidates who are a bit stroppy, maybe they go into the bin. Maybe you'd better not say, to be honest with you.
I don't put anybody in the bin, but I think you make a mental note. Having said that, I have been challenged very politely and nicely by people. And on occasions, I have missed some of their experience. And on a couple of occasions, they've ended up getting the job. But because they put it very nicely and said, I'm slightly surprised because, you know, you may not have spotted it, but that sort of job, I did do exactly that. And I've gone back and looked and thought, yeah, I missed that because it was five jobs ago or something. And you concentrate on the last recent experience, you missed it. And then I'll call them and say, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm willing to consider you now because they've said it nicely rather than vitriolically, you know, or with a great sense of entitlement.
It comes back to what we were saying earlier, actually, doesn't it, in terms of almost the attitude and the way you present yourself to a recruiter is absolutely critical. And I guess someone could have the most perfect CV and covering letter, but if they've got a bit of an attitude, you know, when you speak to them, you'd be less inclined to put them forward, rightly or wrongly, yeah. I'm guessing.
Absolutely do, yeah. But overall, I do realise that most agencies will not reply to every application and you just have to accept this and move on. But for contract candidates, when I was talking earlier about making a shortlist of decent agencies to get to before you look at job boards, well, the fact that somebody replies to every application, that probably marked it out as one of the 20 to 25% of agencies who are decent and it's a reason for putting it onto your list. So it's useful in that respect, or not if they don't reply.
Yes, and I did mean to pick up on that when we were chatting before about candidates almost having their own preferred list of agencies that they like dealing with. And I think that's something that I'd never kind of considered before. And I remember when I left university, feels like years ago, I was applying for all sorts of different roles with all sorts of different agencies and direct. And I do remember now I think of it, those agencies that I preferred more than others and that I actually wanted to nurture the relationship. So I guess we're not saying be choosy because people aren't necessarily in a position to be choosy, but maybe invest a bit more time in those agencies that people like and kind of gel with. Would that be right?
Well, absolutely. It's partly down to the agency's culture, but mostly down to that individual consultant. You can get really good consultants. And if you do find one, they can make a difference. They can get you an interview. Because if they're really good with the client, they'll have been given interview slots just to fill, and the client will trust their judgment. So they'll give you one of those interview slots if you're right for the job and if you come across well. So it is important to have a good relationship with a consultant, yeah.
Thinking of your experience, and I said we wouldn't add up how many years, but what's one of your most challenging recruitment experiences? We've touched on kind of difficult candidates a little bit. So tell us one of your favourite stories. You must have a few.
Well, I've got three here for you. They're all
brilliant.
Either amusing or weird in their own sort of strange way. Well, one's a slightly awkward one, actually. This is back in the 1980s when things were slightly different social attitude-wise.
Okay.
I received a CV in the post, since long before the emails and internet, really, from a lady. And she put a front sheet on front of her CV, and it just had three words on this front sheet. The first two were just her name. And then underneath in brackets, she wrote the word sterilised.
Oh,
and then,
right.
Even then, don't do that. What are you doing? See what she was trying to do, but no.
That's hilarious. And you just wouldn't get that these days. And I
you didn't get it those days, to be honest.
Well, I was sitting here slightly horrified as you would describe me. I was thinking, oh my God, what's going to happen? Was there kind of some underwear in the envelope or something like that? I was just thinking maybe I needed to put a warning before before the podcast.
No, but the second story was we did all the contract recruitment for a large UK utility company, and one of the long-standing perm employees, a lady had been there a long time. He got approval to give her son a job for the summer before he went off to university.
Yeah.
So we passed his details to process his onboarding and so forth. Now, slightly unusually, but not uniquely, this company carried out drug and alcohol testing on everyone who worked there, right down from the chairman to the most junior administrator. So obviously we booked him up a test. And yes, you probably guessed this, he failed the test.
Oh no,
his
son.
He had cannabis in his system, yeah. So we had to call him and say, I'm sorry, you can't have the job. But what I wonder is, dinner time that evening, the conversation must have been a lot of brilliant. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall then, because his mum probably didn't have a clue. And she'd have been pretty embarrassed with her work colleagues too, because she knew that her son's coming. So, awkward. And then the best one of all, I was interviewing a young lady, this is back in the 90s, so I asked her why she wanted to leave her current job. And she said that morale was low. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a very good company to work for. And so I said, well, can you justify that? She said, yes. She showed me her contract of employment, which I still got a copy of. And the bit where you get dismissible, first warning and written warning offences was really funny. I can't quote you them all, but just to get a written warning, you could get one for any of the following, and I'm quoting verbatim. Mm-hmm. Lack of self-discipline, whatever that means. Generally adopting a negative attitude. Mm-hmm. Setting other employees up to fail. I mean, how do you prove these things? Adopting a blame game. My own personal favourite, sulking and simmering. Then adopting a victim mode.
Wow.
Engaging in corridor meetings. And finally, at the end, always agreeing, being too polite, insincere.
So basically anything, whatever
they want
to pick up on, you could get a written.
Yes, yes. Still got that in writing now. Those are absolutely verbatim what was on her contract. I think it's fair enough that she was looking.
Yeah, I couldn't quite understand why she was looking to move. And I think whoever wrote that contract must have had a terrible experience at some point. I mean, what on earth could be behind all of that? But, you know, it sounds like you can't do right for wrong there. So, wow.
Well, a good employer employs people who can do the job and lets them get on with it without sitting on the shoulder every 5 minutes. This is not one of those, obviously.
No, gosh, I'm glad times have moved on, and I would assume that employer has changed their contracts by now. I would imagine that.
Probably going out of business, studio.
So, I mean, they sound like they could be a bit discriminatory, but let's not get into that kind of legal minefield. So, any top tips to kind of finish with? What any kind of nuggets of wisdom from your time?
Well, just a couple of things then. Please track your applications. especially the ones you've been shortlisted for. Keep a list of jobs that you've applied to. And that helped you because you can then chase up the ones that you feel you're a really good match for if you haven't heard anything.
Yeah.
And then you'd be surprised how many times we've actually called back a candidate and about to discuss the job with them and put them forward. And then the next day we ring them up either for more information or even to arrange an interview. And the response is, oh, can you refresh my memory? Or which one is that? I'll apply for so many. And it makes you think, well, are you really interested in this job, you know? But I understand if you're applying for a lot of jobs, keep a track of all of them.
Yeah.
It's just ordinary. It's just business-like to do that anyway.
Yeah. Surely in that situation, you just wing it anyway and just pretend you know what on earth it is and then quickly backtrack as soon as you finish the call.
Yeah, like when somebody comes up to you at a meeting and you don't recognise them, they go, hi there, and you just think, well, I'll win the conversation until the penny drops, you know. Do that, yeah. And then finally, for contract job seekers, I have written a couple of articles on LinkedIn with some of this information and more. What I say, my name is Les Berridge. Just look me up on LinkedIn. There's nobody else called that, luckily for me. And send me a LinkedIn invite. Ask about the articles and I'll send you a link to them.
Okay, brilliant. That's fantastic. So thank you for that. And also, when we were chatting just at the very start, you were telling me about an initiative that you're involved in kind of locally where you are. And I was quite impressed by it because I hadn't realised that there are kind of stuff going on around the country to help people find jobs. And I know your initiative is local to kind of you, but do you want to just outline it a little bit for people?
Well, it's a company I'm just talking to at the moment. They're based in Danisford and they're a life coaching careers counselling group. And they do work for like the local councils and people like this. Mm. They've just been given some lottery money to help out with employment under COVID, you know, and the current market conditions. And that's just giving people counselling and coaching.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but in addition, for the last 10 years, I've offered what's called a clinic to people. It's just something I do in my spare time. So whoever you are, it's anything to do with getting a job, I give people one-to-one help with how to write a CV, how to apply for a job, how to make a speculative application, how to prepare for an interview, and how to conduct yourself in an interview, just completely free, because it's nice, I think, to give something back. Yeah. And I have to say, some of the successes I've had on that have given me more pleasure than in my professional life. I mean, one example was there was a young lady who was a lap dancer, would you believe?
Okay.
And of course, they work during the night and sleep during the day, but she just married a policeman.
Right.
And of course, as you can imagine, he wasn't happy and he'd given her a year to find another job. She had got a degree in HR and we formed a plan, put together a CV, she made speculative applications, and in the end, you know, it was a happy ending. She got a job in an HR department with a decent company.
Fantastic.
She basically said, I couldn't have done it without you, Les, and she's so grateful. And I have to tell you, that's a pretty nice feeling.
Yeah.
It's a very nice feeling.
Yeah, and it's true kind of that helping people in that way really does just change their lives. And, you know, it's very impactful what the recruitment profession does. And I know that it can be disheartening for applicants, particularly at the moment, but what I was really pleased about from our pre kind of chat was that there's all this stuff going on out there that I had no idea about. And actually, there might be other initiatives that are local to people, you know, throughout the UK. So I guess it's worth, I don't know, getting on Google and having a look to see what might be around, and just to keep an eye out for that. And I think there are a lot of charities and other organisations getting funding from the lottery for this sort of thing, which I think is massively important for everyone right now. So,
of course, it is. We all need some help from time to time. Nobody's an island, so don't be afraid to reach out and seek help if you need it.
Yeah, that's so true, actually. And, you know, if you do reach out, the worst thing that can happen is that someone says no. But actually, if you reach out and ask for help, people will be flattered and they'll say no in a really nice way if they can't help. But most people, I think we'll be pleased to help if they can.
Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, that kind of concludes our chat. So yeah. I hope our listeners have found it really helpful. I've really enjoyed talking to you and getting kind of the inside kind of knowledge. So thank you so much for joining us today, Les. It's been wonderful.
It's a pleasure, Julia. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Empowering Agency Workers, hosted by Julia Kermode. For more information on today's discussion, please visit iwork.co.uk, where you can also join our growing community. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, then we would love you to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. We'll be back at the same time next week.